this journey from neoliberalism to neo-fascism is imminent in the situation of neoliberalism. If we are going to check the growth of neo-fascism, then we have to be prepared sooner or later to confront the hegemony of finance. Therefore, the struggle against finance is something which we have to be prepared to carry out. And I think it is that which is what underlies not only neoliberalism, but the turn that neoliberalism has taken towards neo-fascism in the more recent period.
That's Prabhat Patnaik, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Prabhat Patnaik, From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. Neo is a Greek prefix meaning new. Fascism of the classic variety is associated with Germany, Italy, and Japan. It ends at the conclusion of World War II. But in recent years, there's been a development of a different variety, which is called neo-fascism. From Modi's India to Erdogan's Turkey, neo-fascist autocratic regimes have taken hold. There's a direct connection from the failed economic policies of what is called neoliberalism to neo-fascism. Neoliberalism was given a huge boost in the 1980s by Reagan and Thatcher. Its characteristics are deregulation, cutting government spending, shredding the social safety net, privatization, and tax cuts for the rich. The result? Widespread immiseration and discontent. In its wake, demagogues exploiting the situation have come to power by scapegoating and instigating violence against minorities, coupled with loud calls for getting our country back and lots of flag waving. Our guest today is Prabhat Patnaik. He's an internationally renowned economist and professor emeritus at the Center for Economic Studies and Planning at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. He's the author of many books, including Monopoly Capitalism, and with his wife, Utsa Patnaik, of Capital and Imperialism. He spoke in New Delhi on January 24th. And now, Prabhat Patnaik.
The topic I chose to speak on is From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. That's because of the connection between neoliberalism and neo-fascism, which is not much discussed. We think of neo-fascism, which currently is a tendency that is sweeping the world. We think of it as entirely a political phenomenon, but on the other hand, it has very deep political economy roots. And I think I would like to talk a little bit about the political economy roots. Neo-fascism, as you know, is very strong currently, whether it is Poland, whether it's Hungary, whether it's India, whether it is the United States, whether it's Britain, France, Germany, everywhere there is really a fairly strong neo-fascist upsurge. In some places, it is in power, but even when it's not in power, it is really a major political tendency. Now, the point is, I want to argue that this political tendency is something which has arisen as a sequel to the neoliberal process of development, neoliberal strategy of development, which has been again adopted all over the world. Now, I believe that the neoliberal strategy is one which essentially expresses or reflects the hegemony of globalized finance. That all over the world now, there is a tendency towards a globalization of capital, where capital from the north, from the global north, is now beginning to invest also in the global south. I should say that this is something that had never happened historically. For instance, in the colonial period, of the total British foreign investment that took place, anywhere in the world, only about 10% came to the British Empire. I mean, I'm talking about British Empire in the sense of the tropical British Empire. It went to the United States, Canada, and so on, but that's not something which I'm really concerned with. So typically, industry remained located in the north. It did not move south. While in the south, deindustrialization took place, whereby you actually had our artisans and so on being displaced, but nothing came to really take its place. Entrepreneurs started setting up industries. They faced very stiff tariff and other kinds of barriers in northern markets. So basically, the world got divided into a north that specialized in manufacturing and industry. And now that is now, at any rate, beginning to change under the current globalization. That now northern capital is beginning to set up industry in low-wage southern countries, whether it's China, whether it's Indonesia, whether it's Malaysia, whether it's Vietnam, and so on, and including other activities like services. India is a favorite destination for service activities. Now, therefore, you have a globalization of capital. But it is not only globalization of capital in production, you also have globalization, above all, globalization of capital as finance, as something that simply moves around. As a matter of fact, of the total cross-border flows of finance, only 2% are trade related. In other words, which involve the movement of goods of various kinds. Much of it is really purely finance, which is whizzing around the world, and it's whizzing around the world in search of speculative gains and so on. So globalization, above all, from the point of view of political economy today, entails globalization of finance. Now, notice one thing. If you have globalization of finance, but we live in a world of nation states. Now, therefore, it is a nation state, no matter whether the French state or the Indian state or the Polish state, facing globalized finance. In this situation, you have the nation state necessarily having to obey the dictates of finance. Because if you don't, then finance would leave your shores. Therefore, you have a situation where more or less all governments, no matter what their ideological complexion, even if tomorrow you had a socialist government coming to power in India, as long as it remains stuck in this process of globalized finance, namely finance can come in and go out at will, it will also necessarily have to follow the kind of strategy that globalized finance dictates. Well, the kind of strategy that globalization finance dictates is, in fact, the neoliberal strategy. Neoliberal strategy has a number of implications. We all know that, can relatively free flow of goods, relatively free flow of finance, relatively free flow of capital, the withdrawal of the state from the public sector, and of course, complete freedom being given to the corporate financial oligarchy in every country, which is a part of this globalized finance, which is locked into this globalization process, globalization of finance, complete freedom to the corporate financial oligarchy, and so on. But it has some implications, which of course are analytically very important from my point of view as I'm going to develop the argument. One implication is that it wants a withdrawal of the state. The neoliberal policies necessarily want a withdrawal of the state from a whole range of supporting roles that in the state used to have vis-a-vis petty production, vis-a-vis small-scale production, and so on. And this is so everywhere. In the name of controlling the kind of fiscal balance, in the name of cutting down fiscal deficit, in the name of reducing taxes for the corporate financial oligarchy so that they manage to make more investment, you cut down expenditure. And when you cut expenditure in the kind of expenditure the government used to incur in supporting the petty production sector, including peasant agriculture. the withdrawal of the state from supporting petty production and peasant agriculture is one of the hallmarks of neoliberal policy. We know what it means. We know with thousands of kisans outside the borders of Delhi, we can actually see this. But this is something which is not just an aberration. This is something which is a part of the neoliberal policies. It's just the fact that many previous governments have been really chary of following this policy to its limit, while the current government is one that really follows it. But the point is that the demand for state withdrawal of support from peasant agriculture is and from petty production generally is a demand that is really a hallmark of neoliberal policies. Now, one implication of this is that naturally, if you have peasant agriculture has been sustained through, has survived because of this kind of government support, you know, for a variety of reasons. World prices fluctuate a great deal as far as agricultural commodities are concerned, unless the government comes to sustain the peasantry in periods of price crashes, then of course they would get into debt. And when they get into debt, then over a period of time, they lose their land, they lose their livelihoods, and so on. So because of the withdrawal of government support from peasant agriculture, above all, there are three or four very clear ways of withdrawal of support that I can immediately cite to you. Earlier, we had, you know, now, for instance, minimum support price, procurement price, and so on, all of which sustain the peasantry against price crashes. Earlier, they actually covered a range of crops, including cash crops. You had the tea board, coffee board, coconut, etc., all of them had a marketing role in which they actually sustain the peasantry against price falls. But all the board survived, but the marketing role is gone. As a result, they no longer sustain the peasantry against this. Now, in fact, other than rice and wheat, there's hardly any crop in which you actually have that kind of support operation. And rice and wheat is what they are trying to withdraw from, because, as I said, this government pursues neoliberalism blindly, while the earlier governments had some kind of fear and some kind of scruples that the peasantry is going to oppose. Therefore, they were chary of withdrawing complete support from this kind of price intervention. Now, that is one instance. The second instance is, you know, this is something which is often not recognized because of the privatization of a whole range of essential services, including education and health. They have become very expensive. Now, the peasantry, which earlier used to access the public education and health schools, for instance, is now in a position where it has to pay much higher prices for the same services. And that's a very important way, which is not recognized statistically. If you simply look at the prices that the peasants have to pay for various manufactured goods and the prices that they get on their agricultural goods, you would not catch this. But look at the real, what the terms of trade is, you also have to look at the prices, effective prices that the peasant has to pay for a whole range of services that they have to access. So when you look at it, this was one of the major reasons for the peasantry getting into debt. For instance, when I was in Kerala, we set up a debt relief commission, and the debt relief commission found that the most important reason for debt was health. Basically, if my father falls ill, in that case, I'll take him to a hospital. I take him to the nearest hospital, naturally, and the nearest hospital would be often a private hospital. Kerala still has public hospitals which are quite effective and functioning. But think of any other state, and the public hospital would charge the earth for actually treating my father. So the point, and there are numerous horrendous stories that most of you will be familiar with, of people selling land in order to raise resources to get treatment in a private hospital, which is the only place that they can go to. So that is a second way in which withdrawal of support from peasant agriculture and petty producers has really squeezed them very, very badly. Then you can think in terms of the kind of research. You know, earlier, green revolution technology, whatever you may think of the green revolution, but that technology did raise yields significantly, and that technology was developed in India. And through an extension service, it was spread all over the country. Now, public research of this kind is virtually absent, and the entire extension network has been demolished. Because of which now you have, for instance, all these Monsanto and so on agribusiness firms going to the villages and you know, through agents and distributing their seeds, and you know the implications of all that. Now, because of this, the withdrawal of government support from agriculture has really pushed peasant agriculture into a situation where it is barely profitable to remain in agriculture. Now, this has meant that, you know, for instance, in India, the census data, I'm comparing 1991 census with 2011 census. Census data classifies the agricultural population, you know, the agricultural population into cultivators and laborers. 15 million cultivators have simply ceased to exist. The number of cultivators between 1991 and 2011 has gone down by 15 million. Some of them may have become laborers, others must have migrated to the cities. But when they migrate to the cities, there are no jobs in the cities. And that's where I come to the second aspect of neoliberalism, that because you are now an open economy, because exports, I mean, you know, kind of you have to export as, you know, against, competing against other countries, your imports from other countries are coming in. Therefore, all kinds of restrictions on technological, come structural change, which used to be there earlier, are restrictions that are completely removed. Now, for instance, you know, in the earlier, for instance, handloom, there was a reservation for handloom. You could not simply introduce technological progress as you liked. You could not simply introduce automation as you liked. There were restrictions on it. Most of those restrictions are gone because of which there are very high rates of labor productivity growth. Now, many of our people, you know, I mean, maybe political leaders, they don't understand this. Gandhiji understood it, that if you have, you know, the rate of growth of employment is simply nothing else but the rate of growth of GDP minus the rate of growth of labor productivity. Now, if you have high rates of labor productivity, in that case, you have, for any given rate of growth of GDP, low growth of employment. And this is exactly what has happened. Now, many of our political leaders laud, oh yes, the country has very high rates of labor productivity, but they don't realize that high rates of labor productivity means you're creating much fewer jobs. Now, consider the period from 2004-5 to 2009-10. This was a period in which GDP growth was virtually at the rate of 8% per annum. Now, it was a very high rate of GDP growth. Now, during that very period, the rate of growth of employment, of course, what do you mean by employment? If you take what is called usual status employment, a person who reports that for 183 days, that means majority of last 1 year, I was employed. Person's own reporting, then you find that the usual status employment increased by 0.9% annually. 8% GDP growth, 0.9% is the rate of growth of usual status employment. In that case, obviously, you're not even able to employ the available growth in the natural workforce, let alone the peasants who are getting displaced. They are moving to the cities in search of employment. But at the same time, you find that this employment is just not available. Therefore, they swell the reserve army of labor. Because they swell the reserve army of labor, you find that together with the peasants' income falling, simultaneously, the income of the entire working people, including even the unionized workforce, is affected by this. Therefore, in this period, even though you may have high GDP growth rate doesn't put bread into anybody's pocket onto anybody's plate, you find that the real income of the working people per capita real income of the working people has actually declined on average in this entire neoliberal period. I can give statistics on this if you want. Now, this is a phenomenon which is not just confined to India. This is a phenomenon which is occurring globally. As a matter of fact, Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, made a calculation for the United States. He compared the real wage of male industrial worker in the United States in 2011 with the real wage of a male industrial worker in 1968. And he found that in 2011, it was marginally lower. Now, obviously, it hasn't actually been like that all through. It had gone up, but then it has come down so that in 2011, marginally lower. So throughout the entire capitalist world or the entire world where neoliberal policies have been effective, operative, you actually find that real wages of the working people have not been going up. But at the same time, labor productivity is rising everywhere. Now, if labor productivity rises and real wages don't rise, that basically means that the share of surplus in total output increases. So you have the share of surplus rising in individual countries and also for the world economy as a whole. Now, this has had two implications, one of which is the enormous increase in income inequality and, of course, wealth inequality as well. You know, if the share of surplus rises, then effectively the rich are getting richer, and this is obviously an increase in income inequality. Now, Piketty and Chansal, two French economists, made some estimates about income inequality in India. They used income tax data. Income tax in India was introduced in 1922. So they looked at the entire period from 1922 till today, till about 2013, and they found that the share of the top 1% in national income was much higher in 2013, well, was higher in 2013 than it had been at any time since 1922. Okay. And you remember those days we used to have Maharajas and Zamindars and so on. But even so, the share of the top 1% in 2013 was actually higher than at any time between 1922 and 2013. As a matter of fact, another interesting thing that came out of their analysis is that the share of the top 1% has actually gone down during the what I call the Nehruvian period, up to 1982. In 1982, the share of the top 1% was only 6% of national income. Well, now it is 22%. So the period of neoliberalism has meant an enormous increase in income inequality. The other implication is that suppose you actually have a rise in the share of surplus, a rise in income inequality. You see, out of a rupee that is given to a working person, the working person would spend the entire rupee. But if you give a rupee, not to a working person, but to a surplus earner, let's say a capitalist, then that capitalist would perhaps spend about 50 paise out of it, keep the remaining 50%, 50 paise in the bank to be spent tomorrow or whatever. Therefore, what is called the propensity to consume out of a rupee is greater for the working people than it is for the well-to-do. Pretty obvious thing. Now, because of this, the rise in income inequality or an increase in the share of surplus basically implies that there is a reduction in consumption for any given level of investment. Therefore, there is a problem of aggregate demand. Think of the world economy as a whole. In the world economy as a whole, if there is a certain amount of investment in any period, but income distribution becomes worse, then consumption falls. If consumption falls, then of course, investment plus consumption, which is the total demand, also falls. If total demand falls, then output falls. and then the tendency towards an overproduction crisis. Therefore, increases in income inequality create a tendency towards an overproduction crisis. Now, this tendency towards an overproduction crisis, which had been there right from the day that neoliberal policies were introduced, was somehow kept in check by a number of factors. The most important at the world level was, of course, the so-called bubbles. You know, in the United States, in the 1990s, you had a thing called the dot-com bubble. Dot-com companies' share prices went up very sharply. A lot of people felt wealthier. And then you had the housing bubble in which housing prices went up sharply. What happens in a bubble is that the price of the asset is much higher than its cost of production. And it's much higher because of speculative reasons. That I buy an asset knowing that it is much higher than its cost of production because I think that this boom is going to continue in the asset price, that tomorrow I can sell it off for a still higher price. So this keeps going up, up, up and up. Now, the moment this happens, then of course, many people feel wealthier. I mean, obviously, if I have a house whose price is millions, then I feel wealthier. When they feel wealthier, then they consume more, they spend more and so on. And of course, if it's a financial asset, then of course, the cost of borrowing becomes cheaper, etc. So because of this, you had bubble-stimulated demand, which actually kept the tendency towards overproduction in check. But of course, we know the housing bubble collapsed in 2008, after which nothing has come to take its place. And therefore, the world economy is limping along with the tendency towards overproduction, making itself felt. Therefore, the crisis that we see is a crisis which had been there much earlier. What the COVID-19 has done is on top of that. Okay, but even if you leave COVID-19 out, nonetheless, there was a problem of a tendency towards an overproduction crisis in the world economy and in every individual economy of the world. Now, this tendency originally was in the Western world or in the global north, and it had even begun to spread to countries like India and China, which originally did not appear to be kind of afflicted by it. So all over the world, there is a tendency towards crisis, and this is very clear in terms of the huge rates of unemployment that we have been having in our country. Already, in other words, I was talking about unemployment because of the high rate of growth of labor productivity for any given rate of growth of output. But on top of that, there is unemployment now because of a shortage of aggregate demand. There's not enough demand. Therefore, you have one kind of unemployment being superimposed or being additional to another kind of unemployment, and therefore unemployment has emerged as a very, very serious, profound crisis in the Indian economy and, in fact, in every economy. Now, when you have unemployment of that kind, unemployment or crisis is conducive to the growth of fascism. You know that the 1930s fascism arose because of the Great Depression. The Great Depression, particularly in countries like Germany and so on, it created a fascist tendency everywhere. It succeeded in some countries, but in others, even though there was a tendency, it didn't succeed in capturing power. But any situation of crisis and any situation of mass unemployment is a situation that is conducive to the growth of fascism, fascist forces. Why is that? You see, fascist formations or neo-fascist, when we are talking about today, it is neo-fascist. Neo-fascist elements are there in every modern society. Fascist elements are there in every modern society. But they are usually confined to the fringes. But of course, they come center stage when they are propped up by monopoly, by big business, by monopoly capital, or by finance, and in finance capital, and in today's context, and of the corporate financial oligarchy in every country, which is a part of this globalized finance. Therefore, in today's world, the reason why you have these kinds of fascist elements coming everywhere is because suddenly globalized finance or the corporate financial oligarchy in every country suddenly props them up. This is true in our country. We all know which are the political elements which are best funded now and which are kind of, you know, really so rich that they can buy up every other party and buy up people from every other party and so on. But in any case, they have enormous resources suddenly in their hands. The same had happened in the 1930s when Hitler had been propped up by a number of big business houses. So the thing is that, you know, this is a very common phenomenon, that in periods of crisis, neo-fascist elements or fascist elements are propped up by big business. In fact, a very well-known Polish economist called Mikhail Kalecki defined fascism as an alliance between fascist upstarts and big business. Now, something of that kind is always there. I'm not saying that describes fascism in every country. I mean, but that's an element of fascism in every country, neo-fascism as well as early fascism.
You're listening to Prabhat Patnaik, From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977.
And why do they do this? They do this because in a period of crisis, people begin to get disillusioned with the system. And therefore, they begin to ask questions about the system. And when they begin to ask questions, then they begin to challenge the system. And therefore, it is important to find an explanation for the crisis that blames not the system, but what you may call the other. That it is not capitalism that's responsible for the crisis, but the Jews. It is not capitalism that's responsible for the huge unemployment in America. It is the Mexicans. It is the Chinese who are stealing jobs. It is the Muslim immigrants and so on. So that, you know, fascism consists of changing the discourse in such a manner that actually the other is always shown to be the villain of the piece behind the people's suffering. And this is something which we can also see, you know, the religious minorities or, you know, Muslims and so on are responsible for the ills of the country. So it changes the discourse, and what is more, it actually finds a villain for the misery to which people are reduced in periods of economic crisis. Now, this fascism, however, there's a big difference between the fascism of the 1930s and the neo-fascism of today. Fascism in the 1930s actually did get rid of unemployment. I mean, the first country to climb out of the Great Depression was Japan, because Japan did military expenditures and therefore pushed the economy pretty close to full employment. The second country to get out of the depression was Germany in 1933, Japan in 1931, Germany in 1933. Fascism overcomes the crisis of overproduction by generating demand through military expenditure. Okay, and this they can do because, after all, you know, this is something which, you know, normally, you would find that big business is opposed to the state playing a proactive role in generating demand to overcome unemployment, because of the fact that they're worried that this is something that might actually give the state ideas, that basically the state may encroach on the role of capitalists and so on. But in the fascism, because it is actually the capitalists themselves controlling the state machinery, you find no such scruples, no such fears. And therefore, in the 1930s, it is the fascist countries that actually managed to overcome the crisis. Therefore, there was a brief period between, let's say, 1933 in Germany and 1939, when the war began, during which the Nazi government was quite popular because the horrors of war had not visited Germany. But on the other hand, you actually had the horrors of unemployment being banished in these countries. But contemporary neo-fascism is incapable of that, because in Germany you had the nation state, and the nation state was facing finance capital that was itself national, Therefore, it could in fact discipline finance capital. In today's context, the nation state, even in countries which are neo-fascist, is facing finance capital that is globalized. Now, let me just say a few things here about what is required in order to overcome the crisis of overproduction. If the government spends 100 rupees, but it spends the 100 rupees by taxing the working class 100 rupees or taxing the peasants 100 rupees, taxing the working people 100 rupees. In that case, the working people's consumption would go down more or less by the entire 100 rupees. As I mentioned, that really their propensity to consume is pretty high, pretty close to one. But on the other, so there's very little addition to aggregate demand. If I take 100 rupees from a worker who would have spent it otherwise, and I spend this, and I'm the government, then there's no net addition to demand. There's no net increase in demand. Net increase in demand would arise only if either the government finances by not taxing anybody, which is what we call fiscal deficit, or alternatively, the government finances the expenditure by taxing the capitalists, because their consumption is out of the 100 rupees, would be only, let's say, 50 rupees. So their consumption goes down by 50 rupees, but on the other hand, government expenditure increases by 100 rupees, so there's a net increase in demand of 50 rupees. But both these expenditures now, or both these ways of financing government expenditure now, are really opposed by globalized finance. Globalized finance is opposed to fiscal deficits. We know that every country in the world, except the United States, has legislation limiting fiscal deficits to 3% of the GDP. There's no reason for it, but this is something which has to do with the fact that the social legitimacy of social legitimacy of capitalism is something that gets undermined if the government comes in, and therefore global finance is opposed to fiscal deficit, doesn't like fiscal deficits, and of course when finance is globalized while the state remains a nation state, and therefore you have a situation where fiscal deficit is out, meaning unless the government is willing to confront globalized finance. Taxing the capitalists, of course, there would be objection, because then you know, capitalists would object to being taxed. It's going to affect their incentive to invest, even such investment that they were undertaking. They may not do anymore. At least they would threaten. They may not do anymore. They would say that this is going to affect our animal spirits. And of course, if a government taxes too much, then you would find that there would be an outflow of capital. So the thing is that taxing capitalists, particularly in a neoliberal regime, is very difficult, and fiscal deficit is difficult, which is why even a neo-fascist government in a particular country, because it is facing globalized capital, globalized finance, would not be able to overcome unemployment the way that you had in the 1930s, Germany and Japan overcoming unemployment. Now, this has a number of implications. You know, one implication, of course, is that the kind of social legitimacy that they had got in the 1930s would not be available to the fascist governments. As the time passes, then they would become to be more and more repressive and begin to be, therefore, more and more divisive. So that's going to be one phenomenon. The other phenomenon is that even if, you know, fascism burned itself, has historically burned itself out. Now, in countries where all this neo-fascism is emerging, you're not going to have wars, you're not going to burn itself out through wars. But on the other hand, it might actually even lose elections. But when it loses elections, it might actually come back again. So it would remain with us for a very long time, giving rise to a progressive fascification of our society. So this is a phenomenon which we cannot just say that if it's out of office, then everything is okay, because even if it's out of office, this is going to remain. Like Trump is out of office, but Trumpism would actually remain. So you have this situation that this fascism is likely to be a longer lasting phenomenon. I think neo-fascism as a tendency would be with us for a very long time. This is something which is common to all countries, but of course, every country's fascism has its own specific character. One of the things, for instance, one would ask that, okay, I mean, after all, these fascist elements, they're not just kind of, you know, manipulated by the corporate financial oligarchy, and whenever they get there's money coming their way, they come to power and so on. Now, that is, of course, a very important element, but there are obviously things, I mean, for instance, in the case of German Nazism, the Treaty of Versailles had treated Germany very badly. And that is something which actually was exploited by the Nazis in order to come to power. Now, similarly, in India, there is of late, you know, this is the other contribution of neoliberalism. One is this inequality and the crisis generated by it. The other contribution of neoliberalism is that it has actually produced a relatively better off middle class, urban middle class. Urban middle class has been a beneficiary of neoliberalism. I'll give you an example from my own life. You see, when I first joined ANU as an associate professor in 1974, my monthly basic salary was 700 rupees. Today, if someone joins as an associate professor, then the monthly basic salary, basic I'm talking about, would be at least 50,000 rupees. When I joined ANU, the procurement price of wheat was about 70 rupees per quintal. Today, it'll be about 1,500 rupees per quintal. So even an academic, and mind you, academics are not necessarily the most obvious beneficiaries of neoliberalism, but even an academic is better off today relative to a peasant, which is 3.5 times. If both were equal in 1974, then the peasant, the academic's income today would be 3.5 times that of the peasant. Now, the middle class has done quite well. I don't have to labor the point out of neoliberalism. And in the process of doing well, the middle class has obviously developed attitudes. Attitudes which are contemptuous of the poor. For instance, if I'm doing very well, then I'm not going to be told that, look, I'm doing very well because, let's say, neoliberalism is helping me. Our society is helping me. I'll say I'm doing very well because I'm talented. Therefore, if you have an increase in inequalities in that sense, then the increase in inequalities tends to rationalize itself through attitudes of contempt, through attitudes of contempt for the Dalits, attitudes of contempt for the minorities, attitudes of contempt for the excluded. And this is something which, on the one hand, promotes the kind of ideas underlying neo-fascism, and what is more, also puts the fear in the minds of the middle class that has been doing very well, that look, if you have this upsurge of Dalits and minorities and so on and so forth, then that's going to affect our privileged position. In other words, you find that a social prop of neo-fascism is in fact in the kind of class that has generally done well out of the neoliberal order. If you, you know, this was not the case earlier, but this is a major change that is taking place in the Indian political landscape. So for all these reasons, we are going to be left with a situation where neo-fascism is going to be a feature of our society. Even when it's out of power, you cannot rule it out. It's going to remain a feature of our society in the days to come. But how do we get out of it? How do we? You see, in order to get over neo-fascism, to get out of neo-fascism, we have to get out of the conjuncture of the social situation that has produced neo-fascism. And that situation, as I said, is a situation of crisis. Now, in this crisis, overproduction crisis, it's very important to stimulate the economy, to stimulate demand. And for stimulating demand, the most important thing is for the government to spend. Now, as I said, the government, if it spends by taxing the workers, doesn't help in any stimulus of demand. But on the other hand, it has to enlarge its expenditure at the expense, I mean, either through a larger fiscal deficit, or you cannot go on sustaining a large fiscal deficit ad infinitum, and therefore it'll have to tax the capitalists. Now, This is something, therefore, which we're going to be opposed by globalized finance, by the domestic corporate financial oligarchy, and so on. And as a result, two possibilities are there. One is getting rid of the hegemony of finance. Suppose at the world level, all capitalist countries, and major ones, got together and said, we are going to stimulate demand in the world economy by having a larger fiscal deficit, a coordinated fiscal stimulus to the world economy. In that case, finance would have to more or less willy-nilly accept this proposition. Finance then would have to accept this proposition. That would mean breaking the hegemony of finance. But this is a matter on which there is not even any conversation going on at this moment. Therefore, the hegemony of finance in the current epoch of capitalism, nobody is even talking about breaking it. Many people are talking. For instance, Biden the other day announced a $1.9 trillion package, which involves taxing the rich and which also involves making transfers to the working people. But on the other hand, the fact that if Biden persists with this, then there's going to be opposition of finance, and how to deal with that opposition is something which nobody is talking about. In other words, there's no talk about a coordinated response within the context of capitalism to rescue capitalism from this crisis. The alternative is, of course, for countries to, in stages, I'm not saying immediately, in stages, to de-link themselves from this process of globalization. Namely, that you'd have to have capital controls. As I said, suppose tomorrow in India you had a significant increase in wealth taxation in order to finance transfers to the poor. In that case, globalized finance may start leaving the country. You may suddenly have an exodus of finance. If you have an exodus of finance, then you would not be able to meet your trade deficit, and therefore you would have to have a control on capital outflows, of course. But when you have control on capital outflows, inflows would dry up. Then you'd have to have some control on imports and so on. So all that would mean getting out of the vortex of globalization. Therefore, the point I'm trying to make is that this journey from neoliberalism to neo-fascism is imminent in the situation of neoliberalism. If we are going to check the growth of neo-fascism, then we have to be prepared sooner or later to confront the hegemony of finance. And of course, if you're talking about an individual country like India, then that individual country would have to opt out of this globalization by being ready to put capital controls, trade controls, and so on and so forth. Therefore, the struggle against finance is something which we have to be prepared to carry out. And I think it is that which is what underlies not only neoliberalism, but the turn that neoliberalism has taken towards neo-fascism in the more recent period. When I talk about globalized finance, I of course mean also its domestic face, which consists of the corporate financial oligarchy. People who are, of course, investing in India, they're also investing abroad, they are also globalized and so on. They are integrated into this phenomenon called global finance. So they're, as it were, the local components of globalized finance. Therefore, we have to be prepared to face them. Now, in order to do that, there is a very important political requirement, and that political requirement would have to consist of mobilizing the workers and peasants, mobilizing workers, peasants, petty producers, even small capitalists and so on, all of whom are tired and fed up with the ongoing crisis that neoliberalism has generated, and neo-fascism taking advantage of it, but not really resolving the crisis. Even without any political intervention, the peasantry has now come on the streets and is launching a glorious struggle, in my view, against the corporate encroachment on peasant agriculture. It is not only corporate encroachment, it is also an imperialist encroachment. You see, there are several aspects of the farmer struggle. One is against the corporate encroachment into peasant agriculture, because obviously with contract farming and so on, you are going to have a situation where the peasants over time would become indebted, and where you would have, like in the colonial period, you have contract farming giving rise to peasant indebtedness, peasant dispossession. Everything the farmers are saying about losing their land and so on over time is absolutely true. The second aspect of it, which is often not as well appreciated, namely that for a very long time, you see, when you have contract farming would not ask you to produce food grains. The global north has plenty of food grains. The Americans have plenty of food grain stocks. The Europeans have plenty of food grain stocks. They would want you to move out of food grain production in order to produce all kinds of cash crops, which they cannot produce. Climatically, they cannot produce. They cannot produce fruits. They cannot produce a whole range of agricultural crops, which we can produce in the tropical climate, and what is more, which we can produce in periods when they also, even if they could produce in some period, they would not be able to produce in other periods. Now, this is a phenomenon which always imperialism has been putting pressure on us to move from food grain production to cash crop production. This is something which was insisted upon in the Doha round of the WTO negotiations. And as a matter of fact, the Doha round remains stuck because no previous Indian government had actually dared to do what the Modi government has done in terms of hurting the peasantry, hurting the consumer, hurting the economy as a whole. Because obviously, if you move from food grains to cash crops, then your public distribution system collapses. You cannot run a public distribution system by importing from abroad. Whenever India goes to the world market for importing food, food prices will shoot up because speculators would find it very profitable if India goes to buy food from abroad. And therefore, you'd have a reenactment in India, of the kind of thing that Africa has been facing for a very long time. Africa gave up producing food grains and instead moved towards cash crop production. And all of us have seen the kind of pictures of Africa with periodic famines, which particularly in the last century and early this century, and India would actually be facing that kind of a situation. For a country, certainly a country the size of India, if you are going to have food security, you have to produce the food yourself. And if there is food grain stocks lying around, generate purchasing power, put it in the hands of the people. It's because of people's destitution that we actually have so many million tons of food grain stocks lying around. Therefore, the stocks have to be used by putting purchasing power, not by reducing food grain production in the country. So the struggle of the farmers is not just a struggle which is for their own benefit. The struggle of the farmers is something which is also for us, or for everybody, because this is something which is essential for keeping food security in the country, for ensuring that the country has food security, and so on. And the farmers have taken on this hegemony of the corporate financial oligarchy in a way that even political parties have not been able to do. And I think it's very important that we actually remain grateful to the farmers and we actually join in their kind of struggle and solidarize with them. I think I better stop there. Thank you.
You were just listening to Prabhat Patnaik, From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. He spoke in New Delhi on January 24th. Prabhat Patnaik is an internationally renowned economist and professor emeritus at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive, and in our 35th year, we are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call, 1-800-444-0000. 1977. Special thanks to Bala Narasimhan and the New Socialist Initiative. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Vilayat Khan, Raga Puriya.